I am Peter Yassi of American University Law School, and I'm here speaking in the first instance on behalf of the Association of Research Libraries and the American Library Association, and then secondarily, if time allows, to say a few words on my own behalf. I've got several general goals in these brief remarks, an expanded version of which I'll submit for the record. The first is to point out that the kinds of innovation that copyright law does and should encourage aren't limited to those with near-term entertainment, information, or other kinds of economic value. That is to stress the importance of innovations by schools, libraries, and cognate cultural institutions as part of the field of innovation to which the committee should attend. The second is to urge that the perspectives and objectives of those who advocate for new distribution models, such as open access and public access, be fully represented in the work of the committee, and I think we're off to a very good start with that today. And finally, third, to assert that limitations and exceptions to copyright protection in balance with that protection itself contribute crucially to both economic and cultural innovation in ways that risk being systematically underreported. I begin by noting, and now I'm speaking in or on behalf of the libraries, that the widespread use of digital information technologies has fundamentally changed the conduct of academic research and the ways in which research results are shared and made available to the public. In science and other disciplines, many researchers, like all users of information, find that some conventional applications of copyright law present barriers to the effective use and reuse of information. And as a result, new models of scholarly communication, many of which we've heard about this morning, have emerged based on open access principles. They promote discovery and they advance communication and learning by removing barriers to interchange among scholars. These new models have now moved well beyond the academic domain, as many independent researchers, students, and members of the public rely on open licensing, such as Creative Commons licenses, to promote new uses of information. Specifically, to take advantage of these opportunities and to further their mission of creating, preserving, and disseminating knowledge, many academic institutions and libraries are taking steps to capture the benefits of open access by developing campus policies for timely, free online dissemination of institutional research results. And institutions have also established institutional repositories to make their intellectual assets broadly and freely available. These are important initiatives, and I think the committee should recognize their importance and assure that proposals that emerge from its work do not interfere with this line of development. Also, the committee should recognize that these developments aren't in any sense anti-copyright, nor do they undercut the strength of the copyright system. Rather, they represent innovative uses of the legal authority that copyright vests in authors to directly promote scientific, cultural, and other forms of progress. Recently, the federal government has recognized and encouraged the importance of public access policies as a means of fostering and focusing innovation. Pending legislation would go even farther, conditioning the receipt of federal research support generally on the timely making available of research results on public access platforms. And these initiatives, too, represent an effort to further the same fundamental public policy goals as copyright itself, but by other means. Specifically, these developments, this movement toward public access, are fully consistent with a basic principle of the copyright system, that is that the individual or entity that pays the price of innovation should have a say in how the results are communicated. In addition, it's important to remember that copyright is an author's right, not a publisher's right, and that public access policies are entirely consonant with copyright law. They govern contractual terms between authors and their public funders. The committee should recognize that ultimately this movement toward public access is a development in federal procurement policy rather than in intellectual property law. The widespread use of information technologies has fundamentally changed education and library services, as well as how users in general access information. Libraries and educational institutions provide access to copyrighted, licensed, and public domain information. They support scholarship and teaching. They preserve and make available the record of our culture. They serve communities with special needs. Specifically, to perform these functions effectively, libraries rely on robust, vibrant, dynamic copyright limitations, and among these, the doctrine of fair use plays an increasingly critical role, especially as other provisions of the law, Section 108, Section 110, fail to keep pace with change. As internet service providers, libraries also depend on the safe harbor provisions of Section 512 to fulfill their institutional missions. Currently, terms and conditions in many licenses from traditional publishers and other information providers interfere with the operation of the general default principles of copyright law, especially with relation to limitations and exceptions, preventing users, in many cases, from building on or reusing licensed content, and in many cases, prohibiting emerging forms of non-consumptive research. The committee should recognize the contribution that limitations and exceptions appropriately balanced with copyright protection make in encouraging innovation in the academic and library setting, in the arts and in culture, and of course in the information industries themselves. Now, let me shift and say a few things on my own account. Established businesses, startup entrepreneurs, journalists, artists, and other members of the public also rely on robust limitations and exceptions to create the space necessary for both economic and cultural innovation. The value of copyright protection to our innovation system is inextricably tied up with the proper functioning of limitations and exceptions, a point that's well underlined in the recent CCIA study on fair use in the U.S. economy. Specifically, proposals to constrain, specify, or otherwise limit the development of the fair use doctrine threaten the vitality of a system that has contributed significantly to U.S. innovation over centuries. And the committee should recognize that properly balanced limitations and exceptions enhance the effectiveness of copyright to promote innovation of all kinds rather than diminishing it. There are numerous current features of copyright doctrine that have the potential to interfere with innovation in years, decades to come. Specifically, in general, the high statutory damages awards available under copyright law currently chill many individuals and firms from engaging in otherwise legitimate follow-on uses of copyrighted materials. In particular, the constraints on statutory damages awards, where libraries and educators are concerned, have failed to keep pace with technological change in that they currently apply only to liability for wrongful reproduction. Copyright industry opposition has so far doomed legislative proposals to address the increasingly important orphan works issue, which has been widely or a solution to which has been widely recognized as a potential win-win for innovation. The committee should recognize that old and new flexibilities in copyright law, including ones developed in light of new conditions, are essential to the goal of assuring that copyright serves rather than hampers innovation. Finally, let me suggest that this committee should revisit the question of whether the venerable first sale doctrine of copyright law should be expanded into the digital space by legislative or judicial action. Many innovative projects in the library, education, and cultural sector would be enhanced thereby. Thank you.
Chris, do you have any questions?
Nope, that's fine.
Molly?
Peter, on the last point, could you be a little more specific? There
sure.
are several different dimensions on which first sale is different in the digital age, and so what would expanding it into the digital age mean to you?
Expanding in the digital age would be would entail some tweak, and again, whether it is a judicial one of judicial interpretation or legislative enactment, I think remains to be seen, that would recognize that there are situations in which the possessor of a digital copy ought to be enabled to do with it at least some of the same kinds of things that the possessor of an analog copy, a physical copy, now is enabled to do by Section 109. And currently, of course, because any transfer of a digital copy involves typically the creation of one or more, perhaps many additional reproductions, final and interim, the literal application of the Section 109 first sale doctrine is in doubt. But we have many emerging projects that envision, for example, online-based systems for the lending of texts, which are potentially powerful tools, and the space for which, the legal space for which, could be clarified by revisiting and clarifying the application of first sale. This is something I'm happy to expand on in the writing that will follow, but I wanted to at least put it on the list of things for you to think about. Ruth.
Peter, I wondered if what your thoughts are regarding a suggestion that we look at creating special classes of exemptions rather than looking at this problem sort of more generally. So, for example, with libraries, on whose behalf you're speaking, there are already several exceptions, as you know, in the statute for libraries. And the question is, rather than thinking about these as a systemic, sort of research question, would it, in your view, be just as valuable to simply create the kinds of fixes that focus on the special needs of public institutions like libraries or museums, or particular categories of work, which we also have in the copyright statute?
Categories of works, categories of users, classes of use. And with a very important condition that I'm going to name in a moment, I think that's a wonderful idea. In other words, the library community has been fully supportive, for example, of the idea of updating Section 108 to take account of the conditions that now exist with respect to digital preservation, with respect to digital interlibrary loan, and so forth. For a variety of reasons, that effort has not been successful. And I think there are real political problems with coming to terms within the community of affected stakeholders as to how such very specific, very granular improvements could be made. But of course, if it can be done well, it's desirable. However, the other problem with specific targeted limitations and exceptions, whether in this model or in the European model, the model of the 2001 Information Society Directive, or wherever this model has been implemented, is obsolescence. The real problem is that the huge political effort that is necessary to come to consensus about specific exceptions and limitations is one that cannot be, by its nature, frequently repeated. And in a moment of rapid change, cultural change, technological change, change in individual as well as institutional information practices, that risk of built-in obsolescence seems to me to be especially acute. The solution then seems to me perfectly simple and straightforward, and that is we should do our best to update specific exceptions, but we should leave in place a general fair use doctrine with a clear understanding, the understanding that now exists in connection with the relationship of fair use to 108 or the relationship of fair use to 110 or the relationship of fair use to 121, which is that institutional sectoral uses that do not fall within the defined special exceptions may still be analyzed for good or ill, as the case may be, under fair use.
Okay, move on. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Appreciate it.